Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to be talking about a new book that documents our guest's 10 years of research looking into her grandfather's difficult life. Genevieve Davis is in the studio with me, and we'll be talking about her book, Secret Life, Secret Death. She also has made a documentary film of the same name, and her research led her from the gangs of the early 20th century Chicago to the brothels and corruption of 1930s and 40s northern Wisconsin. And you may have heard about the gangsters in northern Wisconsin. Certainly, I know you've heard about the gangsters in Chicago, almost for sure. And maybe you've seen Genevieve's film. I hope you'll call in with your own questions, comments, experiences to share. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Genevieve, welcome back. Great to have you with us again.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Larry.
Well, it's great to have you back. Last time you joined us, you were talking about your first book. It highlighted recipes and stories from your mother's family. Mm-hmm. And this time you're talking about your father's family.
That's right.
What draws you to your family's ancestry?
That's a really good question. I think because I grew up in an alcoholic household, I was looking for the source of, you know, of the family pain. And then also the grandmother that I wrote the book Fanny's Beanie's Kitchen about was a real source of love and comfort for me. So it was kind of, you know, the two polar opposites.
And you looked into your grandmother's life. I mean, it really, the book is about a lot of things, but primarily the primary interest is your grandmother.
Yeah, my dad's mom.
Yeah, and what was the spark that led you into your grandmother's life?
Well, you know, when we were kids, our parents told us white lies about our grandparents because, you know, you don't say your grandmother, you know, was part of the mob and your grandfather was just a sperm donor. But that's basically, you know, like what the situation was. But they told us that, you know, your grandmother died of a stroke and your grandfather died before daddy was born.
So how did you, so eventually, though, the stories got out.
Right. When my father passed away a few years later, I was living out in the woods, and I had a lot of time to think, and I was thinking, you know, I wonder if that story that Dad told about going to Big Jim Colosimo's funeral with his mother when he was 5 years old was true or not. You know, was that just a story that Dad made up for having a bad childhood in Chicago, or was that real? So this was in the day before the internet. I went to the library and I got a book on Chicago crime, and Big Jim Colosimo was chapter one.
Yeah. And then why in the heck is that's what
right.
led to the research.
That's right, because I was wondering, well, what were they doing at his funeral? And it turned out that Big Jim Colosimo was called the Whoremaster of Chicago, and he controlled over 200 brothels. And I thought, well, maybe that's why my grandmother left my dad alone all night, because she was out performing in a brothel, not out drinking and partying it up.
Yeah. Well, you learned an awful lot, including was this kind of really sad stories about
yep.
the life of prostitutes in that time period.
Yeah, well, I don't think the life of a prostitute is good in
Ever
any time period,
good, right.
but there were certainly lots of articles about women that had fallen into prostitution. For example, I think her name was Kitty Fox. This is during the Civil War era. Disappeared from her family home, and a couple of months later, there were two people that brought her body back to her family because she had died of venereal disease.
Oh, man. And your mother started out in, your grandmother?
My grandmother started out in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, that's right.
And she had a love affair in a dance hall with my grandfather. And as a result of this love affair, well, and, you know, as part of the love affair, they were apparently engaged to be married. And that was a way for men to have safe sex with virginal women because, you know, she hadn't slept with anyone else. And but it was a sham engagement, according to her sister, who was closest in age to her. And that meant that he was planning on dumping her, and he did indeed dump her. He disappeared when she became pregnant. And so the problem...
Now, what year was this?
This was 1914.
Okay.
And life was very different back then. It's tough being a single mom now, but back then it was really, really hard. And if your family did not stand by you, you were out. You were out of society. There was no way to ever, ever get back in.
Couldn't get a job.
Couldn't get a job. People wouldn't hire you. It was very hard to find a place to live. Her father kicked her out, and she went to live with a sister. Now, this sister had actually probably had premarital relations with her husband and became pregnant, but there was a man to marry.
Yeah.
And she married him, even though he was a drunk and he didn't take care of the family and stuff. But in my grandmother's situation, this guy disappeared. So there was no one for her to marry. And so she was, you know, stuck. And she decided to keep the baby for whatever reason, perhaps because she felt that no one loved her. You know?
Mm-hmm. And that was your dad.
That was my dad. That's right. And it seemed that the household was unsuitable, perhaps because the husband was a drunk, maybe made advances to my grandmother. I don't know. But she, according to her sister, Lily, grabbed at the first straw that came along, and it was all wrong.
It was a guy from Chicago.
That's right. It was a guy from Chicago. And Tony Colleoni... probably he worked for the railroads. Now, whether he actually worked for the railroads or this was just a sinecure, you know, provided by his father, who knows? But as part of working for the railroads, guys would get a pass and they could travel on other railroads. And there were some Colleonis, that's his fake last name. Mm-hmm. There were some Colleonis in Philadelphia who had moved there from New York after their father had passed away. And they were ladies' tailors. And my grandmother's parents had been ladies' tailors.
Okay.
And so, there's a pretty strong connection there. And, you know, he might have said, oh, you know, I'll take care of you in the little shaver. You know, life is great in Chicago and stuff. And then when she got there, you know, she found out differently.
Yeah, and as did your dad.
Yeah.
Who was, what, six, something like that?
My father was just a toddler when he went to Chicago.
Oh, at first, yeah. That's right. And so she wound up in this kind of life in Chicago where she was out. I remember your dad would be waiting for her to come back and she wouldn't come back and so forth.
Right. And that's a technique in human trafficking to get the person out of their home turf and to move them to another part of the country so that they can, do whatever they want to them.
And just to talk a little bit more about Chicago life the whole prostitution business, many of them were just young girls.
Yes, they were. They were underage, and they were tricked into performing in a brothel, basically. You know, they were told, like a lot of, there were pimps and procurers everywhere, you know, and the women were not paid a living wage back then. They were given like $5 a week, even at like a place like Marshall Fields. And so there were procurers that would, you know, prey on these women, you know, and they had to work in department stores. They had to look great, you know, and they couldn't afford it. They could barely afford, you know, enough to eat and to pay their room rent, and that was it. So they were ripe for prostitution. Also, girls coming from the country to go to the city to find work, you know, would be intercepted by, excuse me, by procurers, and they would take them to a brothel, and you know, they would be locked up, beaten, and raped, you know, for 3 or 4 days until they agreed, you know, to perform in the brothel.
So it was a very, very tough time that your mother found her...
My grandmother.
Yeah, your grandmother. Yes. I keep saying your mother. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's my grandmother.
Your grandmother, yeah. Minnie. And she kind of fell into the life?
You know, she was beaten into it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that... I mean, she was a pretty tough person to begin with, I think. And she didn't... You know, but I don't know. I don't know what the facts are. I just know that she went to took my dad to Big Jim Colosimo's funeral and was later running a brothel in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, the brothels in northern Wisconsin. We'll get to that and certainly invite your questions and comments or maybe experiences as well at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. You've actually talked to had people talk to you about the book and say, well, we've got that kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I've screened the film all over the state and also in Chicago and actually all over the country. But in northern Wisconsin, people had some amazing stories. For example, I was showing the film up in Mellon, and there was just a little handful of people up there, you know, to see the film. And I was talking about Eugene Boisinot. And I wanted to say his name. He was the guy who was a CCC foreman, and he was killed by mistake by the FBI. And he was killed by Babyface Nelson. And he, I wanted to use his name because I had read in an article that people remember the names of the perpetrators but not the victims. And so I was talking about Eugene Boisinot, and this lady raised her hand, and she was 94, and she said, "It's not Eugene Boisinot, it's Eugene Boisinot. I knew him. He was a really nice man. He bought me some ice skates." And I'm like, holy cow. And this lady was like, you know, Babyface Nelson himself was murdered in 1932 by the FBI. So this lady knew him. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Bought her a pair of skates.
Right, and he bought her a pair of ice skates.
Oh, man. Well, the whole thing about northern Wisconsin, the Al Capone, the Capone brother, Frank, who's the other one.
Frank Capone, yep.
And John Dillinger, did he make it up there?
Dillinger
yeah,
also
that's
was
right.
up there, right?
And Babyface Nelson, obviously,
right.
as you were talking about. And those guys were, to the people up there, they were pretty darn nice.
They were very nice to them. I talked to a guy named Pat Prince, and he said that they used to give out coupons during the war for tires because tires were made out of rubber and people just couldn't get tire coupons. And they would give out food coupons, and they just made sure that everybody really liked them a lot. Ralph Capone used to, you know, give out bags of groceries, and he would be the first to, he had a bar up in Mercer, Wisconsin, and he was the first person to, you know, help raise money after somebody's house burned down or something. And, you know, they were just very well loved up there.
You had a quote from one person who at some point had said that one of them had kept his family in food for about nine months at one time.
Isn't that amazing?
Going through a hard time, and he kept them in food to keep them going. So there, but people knew who they were.
They did, but they didn't act out up there unless something was going on. For example, like Al Capone's house in Couderay, it was like an estate, and it was, you know, it was just a place for him to hang out. It was like a gangster holiday on the one hand, but on the other hand, he did have a jail up there, which didn't look like a fun place to be. He also had a landing strip for booze to be flown in from Canada, and he had a lookout tower, you know, with slots for machine guns.
Is that still there?
It's still there.
Yeah, I thought it was.
I'm not sure who owns it at this point.
Yeah, you have a photo of it in the...
I do.
You had a lot of photos in your book. Where'd you get all those?
A lot of pictures in the book. Well, a lot of them came from my grandmother's photo albums and her photo album and my dad. And I have to thank my mother for that because my mother saved her mother-in-law's pictures through two sewage floods in the basement. And my mom did not like her mother-in-law. And I said, "Why did you save those?" And she's like, "Well, I don't know. I just thought it was part of your family heritage."
Oh, man. Genevieve Davis, our guest today. She's an artist, film director, and author of Secret Life, Secret Death. And she has a documentary film with the same title, talking with her about those times back then, really about her book, which is a research of her grandmother, Minnie. And the stories surrounding it led her to research on brothels and gin mills and stills and a whole lot more, not only in Chicago, but in northern Wisconsin. Well, even not so north, Portage had a, you talked about a Portage brewery.
Yeah, you know, that was amazing. I ran into Dave Uhlberg, and he supplied me with photographs of the Uhlberg Brewery. Now, he's the grandson of the guys who owned the Uhlberg Brewery. And this brewery operated during the entire time of Prohibition. And if you've ever lived in a place where there's a brewery, like I'm from Milwaukee, you know what it smells like when beer is brewing. So you can't, like, say we're not brewing beer. But they said, oh, we're just brewing near beer. And then finally, at the end of, you know, towards the end of Prohibition, they did get convicted. And one of them got a presidential pardon. And the other one never served any time in prison.
Well, you know, that happened a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, as you write about it, it's really fascinating that, I mean, the here in Wisconsin, the sheriffs and the the judges were all collecting money from people who ran these places.
There was a lot of corruption. And also, they say that Prohibition consolidated the mob's power.
Yeah.
Now, the mob was going already, kind of led by Big Jim Colosimo in Chicago, but he was assassinated, or he was executed. I shouldn't say assassinated. He was executed in 1920.
Yeah. Well, I want to find out some more about why why Minnie wound up at that funeral with your dad.
Yeah.
We'll learn about that in just a second here. But a reminder, join in with your own questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here at 2 o'clock today on the Kathleen Dunn Show. She'll be talking about whether the Democratic Party is doing enough to advance traditional liberal goals. That's at 2 today. Right now, talking with the author of Secret Life, Secret Death, Researching a Life with Roots in Organized Crime. Genevieve Davis, our author, artist, and film director. So join in again with your questions, and let's take a question right now or a comment from Jake in Oshkosh. Jake, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, Larry. I just called to make a comment. I'd like to applaud you and your guest for your show today. It's about time we hear some real Wisconsin history as to the pretend Wisconsin history. I just wanted to compliment you and your guests.
Well, thank you very much. There is a really raw side to the whole.
Oh, yeah. This is the difficult history of Wisconsin.
A very difficult. And Wisconsin, during Prohibition, we had stills all over the place. And you write about several towns that had them.
Well, and yeah, I mean, everybody and their brother was and their sister was brewing beer or making hard liquor because it was so easy. You know, all you do is you get some potatoes, you get a little extra sugar, you know, and you put those together and some yeast and you know, order that from the mill, and you know, you find a little spot in the woods with some water and you've got alcohol.
And so somebody told you, or somebody said, it was quoted as saying, why do you do this, or who's your customers? And well, we're making beer and liquor here in Wisconsin for Chicago.
Well, yeah, but they were also making it for people in Wisconsin, but they were making it in such large quantities, huge, huge quantities, that some of it had to be going down to Chicago. And in fact, I have stories about the Phantom Still in Rhinelander, and I met the granddaughter of the people who ran that still, and it was just huge, huge, huge vats. It's just inconceivable. You have to look at the picture in the book, but to get an idea of how much booze that there was. And her grandmother went down to Chicago one time with a guy to make a delivery, and they it was just like a really scary experience for her because there were some people that...
who were following them.
Yeah, who were following them, and they wound up in a high-speed chase and stuff like that. And that was the last time she ever went to Chicago, probably to go shopping. You know, and they were just supposed to park the car, leave the booze in the car, go shopping or whatever, and come back in an hour, and then there would be, you know, an envelope with bills in
with
the front
seat.
With
money in it.
Yep, that was how they did it.
But that was the last time she went.
That was the last time she went, but you can bet that that booze went down there.
Oh, my gosh. And not only, of course, not only the booze, but brothels were...
Yes, in 1910, 1911, the Wisconsin Vice Commission published its report, the Teasdale Commission, Senator Teasdale, and they did an investigation all over the state in places like Sparta, Superior. In Superior, Wisconsin, I read some of the original transcripts that were in the Wisconsin State Historical Society, and Senator Teasdale found out that one half of the municipal payroll was funded by $53 charges to each brothel in town. And the brothel owners, of course, said, yeah, we have to pay $53 a month. And then all the officials were like, no, we're not charging anybody. And then in Sparta, there were some really fascinating handwritten notes. And in Sparta, somebody said, watch out for even the post office in Sparta, because they're in on it, too. So mail your stuff, you know, to the investigator, mail your stuff from another city.
Oh. Stephen Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Moonshine Hill Road in Crivitz, Wisconsin, between Crivitz and Milwaukee. Do you know any of the history of what was going on up in northern Wisconsin at the time? That's kind of the, there's the Wasaukee Club that's near Moonshine Hill Road. Apparently there were a lot of gangsters that hung out in that particular area. And I'm really intrigued about reading your book because I really want to know more about this history. I'll just hang up and take your answer off the air. But I'd be here interested if you know anything about that history up there.
I don't know anything about that.
The Moonshine Hill.
No, that's a great name for for a road, but I have a feeling it wasn't called that in the 20s and 30s. But there was a definite pattern of corruption that had already been in place before Prohibition started, with the local officials up in northern Wisconsin. And then, you know, when Prohibition came along, it was very easy just to continue that.
Melissa in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
This is a really great show. I think, you know, any Wisconsin history is definitely valued information. My question was about, you know, Prohibition era in Wisconsin. Was it not... likely to have the rules enforced much here? And I say that because this was like 20 years ago. My grandmother and I were visiting her parents' grave sites and whatnot. And I said, well, Grandma, how did your father die? And she said, well, he died a drunk in a tavern. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, that would have been Prohibition. And I said, you know, Grandma, that would have been Prohibition. And she literally looked at me and said, what is that? So is that something that didn't really happen that often here? Or?
No, there were taverns. There were people that would just, you know, open up the back door of their house and they would run a tavern.
Okay.
And it was, and again, there had to be a structure there of officials involved in order to keep it going.
Well, sure. You know, in the town that my grandmother lived in, the sheriff was an elected official, but he had no salary.
Yeah. Unpaid, quote, quote.
That's right. So his method of getting money, and this was after Prohibition, mm-hmm. but his method of getting money was, you know, payoffs from the brothel owners. And if they didn't pay off, and there was one brothel up there that didn't pay off, then he would bust them.
And then they'd pay fines.
That's right.
And the fines would go to him.
Probably.
So.
That really answers my question. I wanted to say that was, you know, my grandmother was from Mondovi, so it was really just everywhere in Wisconsin.
Yes.
From what I understand then, correct?
Yeah. Where is Mondovi?
Mondovi's maybe 20 miles from Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it was happening, you know, there was bootleg being made everywhere. And even my grandfather, my mother's father, made his own booze, and, you know, during Prohibition, and it wasn't legal to make your own booze. But
no.
If you made, you know, just enough wine for your own consumption, you know, that was no problem. But once you started making stuff and selling it, that was different. And then there were payoffs involved, or people were busted. But there were very few people who were actually busted because it was a very unpopular law.
Yeah.
Right. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling.
And I guess I'm sorry that your grandfather died that way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's a heck of a time, and I was going to ask you a question, and it completely flew out of my mind here. But oh, I know, the bigger danger for moonshiners, for example, were competitors.
Well. Yeah, there was a problem with competitors, and then, right, and there were also people who wanted to steal, you know, bootleg whiskey. And then, you know, as time went on, the revenuers, you know, would, you know, the federal government started getting involved, and that's when, you know, it became more difficult for the local officials to actually, you know, cover things up.
But at some point, your grandmother sent your father, who was, I think, maybe 10 or something like
11,
that.
Yeah.
11, to Milwaukee?
She sent him back to Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
And she was supposed to live with Lily, who was my grandmother's closest sister in age. She was like a Vatican twin, you know, like about 10 months younger. And there was another sister that was living at home whose marriage had failed and had a couple of kids living with her in the family home with Mommy and Poppy. And Mommy and Poppy were retired by this time because they retired at about age 50 because Poppy was fooling around with the forelady in his wife's dressmaking shop. And so his wife left him, and he ran the business into the ground, so there wasn't any business, you know, yeah. when they finally made up. So they just retired and let their kids support them. So this daughter that was there said, oh, no, Lily's household isn't moral enough to raise a child, and that's because Lily was living with Jack, and Jack had been married. He was still married to a Catholic, and because she was a Roman Catholic, he couldn't divorce her, and so Lily just moved in with him anyway. And so this sister said, no, he must live with us. And so my great-grandfather apparently took out his ire on his daughter on my dad.
And that went on for, I don't think your dad then saw his mother, your grandmother, for many years.
Right. It was 10 years before he saw her again. And also, when my dad was, so that was when my dad was 21, and when my dad was a few years older than that, his grandfather committed suicide by turning on the gas and downing a bottle of booze. And my dad, of course, was the only person living at home, so he was the one who found him.
Found him. Your mother or your grandmother had a falling out in Chicago.
Right.
And then left and wound up in, eventually, in Spread Eagle, Wisconsin.
Yeah. She took up with, she went to the North Country probably on her own. It's hard to say, you know, was she in trouble with the law, or, you know, what was the precipitating incident. But she went up there, and she took up with Johnny Ville, who was her third partner, and they eventually bought the Hollywood Hotel in Spread Eagle. They were up, you know, in all the mining towns and stuff in the North Country, and then they finally wound up there.
And the Hollywood Hotel turned out to be, they turned it into, or maybe it was already.
Who knows what it already was.
But it wound up as a brothel.
Yeah, it was a bar / brothel.
And what was that like?
Well, my mother is an eyewitness to that. My mom is 92, and she said that she saw young, nicely dressed women spending the weekend with local officials of the town. And I didn't really know what that meant until I went up there. And then I was, you know, asking people about the Hollywood Hotel, and they said, oh, geez, the Hollywood, that was a whorehouse. That's how they talk up there.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I kind of thought that it was anyway.
So they had that, and they had, and then they had the bar down upstairs.
Right. They had the bar downstairs. So I asked Pat Prince, who was my informant up there, you know, how did that work? And he said, well, you know, a guy would come into the bar and then the bartender, which was Johnny, would match him up, you know, with a gal. And if he didn't like that gal, he would match him up with someone else. And my grandmother apparently was always in the kitchen, like cooking and stuff. And I'm guessing that she managed things behind the scenes.
And where did these young girls and women come from?
Well, they say that the gals up north came from Chicago and Milwaukee.
And they would go, someone would go to Milwaukee, let's say, and see some young kids or young girls and say, hey, I've got a job for you or what?
You know, that happened. That actually happened two generations before my grandmother owned that hotel. It happened right in the Spread Eagle area where there was a guy who dressed as a minister and he would look for young women who didn't have, you know, close relations and were looking for a job. And so we would take them up north and then they would get into a stockade. They would lock them up in a stockade. They would be beaten and raped for days until they cooperated. And then they didn't live very long because, you know, they would die of venereal disease or they would be beaten to death. And so there was this constant pressure, you know, for new recruits. Now, in my grandmother's day, there was a time when they were in trouble with the federal law. And so Johnny had just gone down to Milwaukee, and I'm guessing that Johnny went down to Milwaukee to get some more girls to bring them up there so that they could at least make money that way.
Let's turn to KC in Port Wing, Wisconsin. Hi, KC. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Actually, I'm going through Hazelhurst right now, so I know what it's like to drive up north. And people need to remember that in those days, there was no freeway, there was no interstate. The main drag for the whole state of Wisconsin was Highway 13, and you had to take offshoots to get up north to Mercer, Manitowish, Oma, Hurley. It took a day to get from Chicago, if you didn't have any car trouble, up to those places. And a lot of the gangsters, did they like to drink booze and do illegal things, yes, but they also like to hunt and fish. You see a lot of pictures with those gangsters with deer in the background or fish in the background. That's one of the big reasons they like to come up north to get away from it. And as you look at that area today, it has come full circle because almost everything is owned from people from Illinois. So the gangsters did win out, and the fibs have taken over.
The fibs.
Well, they're probably a little truth to that.
Oh, yeah. And Pat Prince, again, my informant in Spread Eagle, he said that he used to go out when he was a kid. Now, he was a child, you know, he was like a pre-adolescent during this time. He used to go out and shoot deer for the gangsters that would come up so that they could strap that on their car and come back home and say, y'all was up there hunting, you know. But
they did a lot of recreating,
sure.
Fish and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, but mainly they were, up there, according to Pat, they were playing cards, drinking, and playing with women.
Joanne in Jacksonport, thanks for calling.
Well, this goes back a ways. When I was in college, that would have been in the 50s, early 50s, a friend and I decided that we, along with many others, would try to find a job at a resort in northern Wisconsin. And so we each landed jobs at Little Bohemia. I think it was nearest Manitowish Waters. But
yes,
really
that's
remember.
Correct. Yep.
And, of course, that's where Dillinger got shot. And a couple of the people that still work there probably, let's see, they might have been young, but they knew a lot more than they'd tell us.
Yeah, Little Bohemia is certainly another part of your story.
Yeah, and Earl Winnetka, who was the owner of Little Bohemia, kind of made a cottage industry out of showing off the Dillinger bullet holes, which you can still see when you go up there. And there's also like a case with, you know, like the high heels, you know, of some of the gals that were up there and Dillinger shirts and a shaving kit and stuff like that.
Yeah, and he did not die there. He was gunned
Dillinger,
down.
No, he died in Chicago in the Biograph Theater.
He got away.
Yep.
The night of the famous battle. I think there were only two people killed in that.
There were two people who were killed, and actually one of the stiffs was collected by a guy who got in touch with me on Facebook, who went with his father, who was a coroner in just over the border in Michigan. And anyway, they went down and they picked up two stiffs.
As he called, in quotes.
Yeah, right. And that had been killed that night.
Yeah. One of them by mistake.
One of them by mistake. That's yeah. right. Was killed by mistake by the FBI.
Let's go to Jim and Kiwani. Jim? Oh, let's see. Let's get Jim on. Hi, Jim.
You know, back in the 30s and that, there was a lot of people settled around Crandon from Kentucky. And that's because the revenueers were after them. For moonshining down in Kentucky, and it got too hot, so they come up here to get away from the revenue guys, and that's why Crandon became such a hotbed for bootlegging. One of the guys up there is called Moon, and his last name starts with an M. And anyway, he had one of the bigger stills in his basement, and they went and checked him out, but they never could find it.
Yeah, that's probably because he had somebody that was telling him when that was going to happen from the sheriff's office.
Yeah, that happened pretty often, didn't it?
When it certainly did.
The state patrol or somebody mm-hmm. would come, but they'd raid and there'd be nothing there.
That's right. That happened in Spread Eagle. There was a raid by the state police, and the local sheriff tipped off the brothel owner, and they moved all the stuff. I think over to the sheriff's house, but, you know, anyway, away. And then, you know, when the state police came, there wasn't anything there, so they couldn't arrest anybody. And can I tell people how to
get
hold of the book?
Absolutely. The book, and people are probably interested in the film as well, but let's talk about the book here.
Yeah. Well, you can get both the book and the film at secretlifesecretdeath.com. That's secretlifesecretdeath.com.
And I believe, Jill, did we put up we have that link on our Facebook page, I'm pretty sure, as well. I'm just trying to look and see now. But we'll have it. If we don't have it up there, we'll have it up there. But just go to secretlifesecretdeath.com.
Yes, thank you very much.
And you can order the book and or the film.
Exactly. You can watch clips from the film, and you can take a look at the book, and you can find out all about why I did the project.
And we just scratched the surface here. We didn't really tell the, and probably just as well not to tell the whole story. but there's some things in there that'll kind of curl your hair, as my mother used to say.
Yeah,
it's very sad things. And in the end, there were some happy things because your dad got married, and here you are.
And here I am. That's right.
There you go. Genevieve, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, Larry, thank you so much for having me.
Again, Secret Life, Secret Death, that's the title of the book and the film. And you can go to secretlifesecretdeath.com. and order directly from there. Genevieve Davis is the author, and we also have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So if you didn't, you know, later you're thinking, oh, I want to get that, you can go to the Facebook page if you can't remember the title, Secret Life, Secret Death, Genevieve Davis. Always fun to have her with us. Susan Troller is another person who it's fun to have stop by as well. And we're going to switch gears entirely and talk with you about raising happy and healthy backyard chickens. Do you have chickens in your backyard? Have you been thinking about it? I have a friend who's been thinking about it here in Madison. She hasn't done anything about it yet. I'm not sure if she ever will. But we're going to get the story of how to do it and all the kind of fun things about the breeds of chickens next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.